Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to another adventure in history. I'm Alana Quigula with Providence Eastside Hospital here tonight with my partner, Mac Burns.
That's the first time, I think, in at least 3 years you have not said Executive Director of Clatsop County Historical Society.
Well, I'd like to point that out because it is an important title.
Well, it is.
Well deserved.
No, it's a team effort. You know, I am the Executive Director.
Oh, but yes.
There's not a portion of things that happen without a huge team, and that's a nice segue because I want to talk about part of that team.
I love it, and that's why I appreciate doing the show with you.
And you are my partner.
Yes.
I kind of hate, co-host still sounds equal.
It does, and we know we're not equal.
We are equal, though.
Oh.
Don't give me that. Okay.
Well, I was going to say I'm the leader.
If we're not equal, then because you're more of a professional, then it's more like 60-40 your way.
I keep you on track and
Now Paulette and Julie, I'll definitely say. but you are of the four of us that have been part of Adventures in History, you are by far the most professional.
We're
amateurs.
Yes. But we have fun.
We do have fun. But hey, we do, from time to time, we pre-record this.
We do.
This is airing on a Sunday night, but we pre-record this, and you were going to be away, so we pre-recorded a number of shows, and unfortunately, this happened about 2 weeks ago, but we lost a member of the Historical Society family about 2 weeks ago, Larry Zeke. He was our custodian for 15 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I kind of hate just saying custodian because he did so much more than that.
Yeah.
And let me first say, he would hate that I was even talking about him on the air.
Because he would know, because he was our most faithful guest.
He was a loyal, consistent listener when we were on another radio station and we aired Wednesdays. He would have lunch with us. He would sit in his truck on his lunch break listening to the show. And regardless of whether he was listening on a Sunday night or when we were on Wednesdays, the next day he would always critique.
Yes. Positive or constructive.
It was always positive.
Constructive,
yes.
I would say.
Yes. Yeah. I trust his opinion more than a lot of people because I knew he was being very sincere and he had thought about it.
And he's invested too in the organization.
Very
and
much
what we're
so.
Sharing. Yeah.
If I mentioned a book, he would go buy that book and read it. Or movie, he would go rent the movie and watch it.
Yep.
So he was just an amazing person. But a little background, when 15 years ago, we were creating a part-time position to be the museum custodian. And of course, we take care of 6 old buildings, operate 4 museums. So we weren't quite sure if 20 hours a week was going to do it or not. We had a person who took care of that, but also did other things. And we decided maybe this was really 2 different jobs. So we were advertising for a custodian. And at the time, Larry had a business cleaning job. A cleaning business.
Yeah.
And I know he did the Bank of Astoria after hours. He'd have a key and code and he'd go in and do the floors and clean up. And he did that for a lot of businesses. And it was actually, it kind of makes me laugh. The name of his company was Brands Spanking Clean.
That's a good one.
And if you called his phone number, he would have a voicemail where he'd say, leave a message and keep it clean. And that always kind of made me laugh.
Good.
And he kept that message for a long time. But he came in, he answered the ad, and he came in, and he said, oh, well, I thought maybe you'd hire my business. And I said, well, I think it's more than cleaning. We're not really quite sure, but I'd like to hire you as an employee. And he thought about it, and he came back the next day. He said, I would like to try that. And then he stayed with us for 15 years.
I love it.
And
Did he keep his other business?
He did for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he kind of slowly phased it out.
Sure.
And he donated some of the equipment to us. He's like, do you want a floor waxer? I'm like, what will we do with a floor waxer?
Wax the floors.
And he'd say, well, the Heritage Museum has some floors that need waxing. And so, he phased out of it, but I don't know exactly when, to be honest. But, the list goes on and on. He gardened. He moved tables and chairs. He did painting, cleaning. He ran supplies between museum locations, and especially like the film museum where the gift shop has so much turnover. He'd come in almost every day, and he'd, what can I do to help you? And he'd get a list, and he'd go to the where we keep the gift shop supplies, and he'd carry boxes down to them. He'd always leave notes like, hey, we're almost out of this. He was like the best inventory control, on gift shop stuff and just office supplies. And, you know, this building is running out of paper. I'll take three over, but now there's only two left.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, things that you wouldn't think a custodian would be responsible for. And he would just take care of it. And there are probably millions of things that he did that we're just now going to discover he did and didn't realize it. And, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of times visitors come to the museum and maybe they see an exhibit and they think, oh, a curator created this. But they never think about, oh, this garden is weeded, or this lawn is mowed, or this bathroom's really clean. Mm-hmm. You never think about.
Right. This old building isn't dusty. Yeah.
I mean, the window's really clean.
Right.
You just don't think of that guy. And Larry's that guy. And he made us just look so good. He was a paid member of the Historical Society.
Oh,
and he was a generous paid member. He was not a $35 individual member or $55 family. I mean, for a guy that was being paid hourly, he was unbelievably generous. And part of that was, I believe in this cause, Mac. Why shouldn't I be a member?
Right.
And I'd say, but you don't need to be a member at that level because I know what you make. And he said, I believe in this. And then he also wanted to, as a paying member, I'd like to voice a concern I have about this organization. How come you're not doing this, or how come you're doing that?
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that I respected him. Always talked about that, or we already talked about that he was a loyal listener of the show.
Yeah.
And always critiqued it. And that brings up KMUN. He volunteered at KMUN. I know he spent a lot of time and took pride in the work that he did for KMUN. I think that, too, was behind the scenes and mm-hmm. some technical stuff. I know he made backup copies of things and did tons of things for them as well. He came to all of our events, Talking Tombstones, Thursday Night Talks. He'd always take photos, and he was really the best documentarian of our events,
more than
anybody else.
Right.
And invariably, like, we'd do Talking Tombstones on a Sunday, and Monday there would be a CD instead of a flash drive, a CD with like 80 pictures, and he would already have kind of archived them for us. So we did that. And then I always love the phrase, what can I do for you?
Mm-hmm.
What can I do for you today? And it was just so amazing. Then he passed away, and it has shocked us all, in our family, in our organization. We have lost a friend and a family member. And again, something you would never expect a custodian to do. He's native born to the region, and he loved history. And he wrote one of the best articles in our Cumtux.
I love it.
That you would ever read. And that's why I say he's more than a custodian, because I dare say most museum custodians are not writing great articles for their journals. And we're never going to get through all of this in the 21 minutes that we have left, because it's a really long article. His mom was a nurse at St. Mary's.
I love it.
That we've done some stories on the air here over.
The original Providence, yep.
Yeah. And his mom was a nurse, and he interviewed a whole bunch of people that learned nursing at the same time as his mom at St. Mary's. And he just did really good research and interviewed a ton of people. It's one of the few issues that have been sold out. All of these nurses wanted copies for their families.
Oh, I love that.
And we actually reprinted it, so we do still have copies of it. But it is the it's the Winter 2011, Volume 31, Number 1, Winter 2011 issue, Nurse Training at St. Mary's by Larry Francis Zeke, or Larry Z, as he frequently signed his name. And if you wanted to, since we're not going to get through all this and we're just going to run out of time here, if you wanted to read this, you could just go to our website, and this is one of the issues you could just call up and read on your computer, maybe even your phone, or we do have copies if you wanted to come in and purchase it. But in honor of Larry, because Larry, we miss you, and you will be very impossible to replace we'll find a custodian, but they're not going to be that kind of person that you were, that you took pride in what you did. You made everybody around you smile. You were always honest and forthright, and you worked unbelievably hard above and beyond your job. So, between 1909 and 1948, St. Mary's Hospital in Astoria, Oregon, ran a nurse training program through which 245 women became registered nurses. What follows is an 11th-hour description of that three-year schooling process during its final transformative decade of existence.
In September 1940, St. Mary's Hospital consisted of two connected buildings. Most patient business and all healing procedures occurred within a western brick section built in 1931, known nowadays as the Owens Adair Apartments at 1508 Exchange. Meanwhile, the wooden predecessor hospital, raised in 1905 and then razed in 1975, stood to the east, containing housing and support services for select females engaged in a study program to pass state nursing exams. Despite the complexities it entailed, nearly 25% of American medical institutions operated such a school inside their walls. They did this to help meet society's exploding need for nurses, plus stock the pool of potential future employees.
And I should say that we've edited this a little bit in a futile effort that we thought maybe we'd be able to get the whole thing, but then we realized. So we are leaving out a little bit. But St. Mary's was owned by a Roman Catholic order based in Montreal, Canada, and we've covered this on the show before, called the Sisters of Charity of Providence. 15 to 20 served locally as hospital overseers, each an expert in whatever department she supervised. Many were registered nurses in their own right, and every floor was managed by one of these RNs. Other nuns were strictly regulators, confined to institutional desk work. All wore an identical black habit, the body covering, white coif headpiece, and silver cross. When working around medical patients, however, a white tunic supplanted the formal black. Each sister's private room, reputedly simple and sparsely furnished, was on the wooden wing's fourth floor. The hospital chapel was likewise located there, as was the in-house priest. This latter pair were accessible to anybody in the community. Indeed, an open mass commenced daily at 6 a.m. By request, the goodly father would also visit patients and deliver communion. You didn't have to be Catholic to receive treatment at St. Mary's, of course, nor to enlist in its nursing school.
So a new contingent of these students was created each September, and its size varied at the outset, yet typically totaled fewer than 20. Some years, a midterm class might matriculate during the month of March. Their rosters were anything but homogeneous, composed of young women whose luggage bore a hodgepodge of educational, social, occupational, and financial stickers. Locals from the Lower Columbia region accounted for a substantial percentage of participants. Portlanders ventured downriver because metropolitan schools had long waiting lists, had stricter requirements, and were substantially more expensive. Yet, irrespective where her home fire burned, every enrollee resided in the East Wing. No daily commute was allowed, even of Clatsop natives. Living facilities were on the second and third floors in spaces which formerly held hospital patients until 1931. Now, layouts ranged from compact quarters for a duo up towards containing four beds. Several of the former had a private bathroom with tub, but most students living on the same floor shared a communal restroom and showers accessed from out in the hall. First come, first served, no sign-up sheet. Now, each person was provided a twin bed, chest of drawers, and either a closet or freestanding wardrobe. No bedside stand, but some had curtained partitions to afford slight privacy. And you brought your own Bible. A study table, which accommodated multiple chairs, usually played a large part in the furnishings. Heat emanated from a radiator whose output could not be regulated. Most of the time, these residences felt cold. A community telephone for both incoming and outgoing calls, local only, no long distance, hung out in the second store hallway by its southern window. Typically, one knew when a ring would arrive, which permitted strategic positioning at the crucial moment. If unable to make that connection, a message was taken and passed on. For cigarette smokers, the second floor also had a blue room, actually an enclosed antechamber to the fire escape, although one nurse recalled classmates making popcorn there. No unit contained a kitchen. In fact, neither food nor drink was officially sanctioned therein unless your family sent a box of goodies.
I always love the idea of hospitals and everybody smoking.
Yeah, you know.
I'm glad we've moved past that.
Yes.
To smoothly assimilate September newcomers into its school routine and free nuns from incessant pestering, St. Mary's encouraged a buddy system. Fresh arrivals were welcome to choose an upper classmate as a big sister to whom she could pose her nuts and bolts kind of questions until fully conversant how things functioned. Also situated on the third floor was the office of the director of nursing, whose primary duty was to maintain a smooth functioning environment for trainees. A secondary task was keeping records required by the state. Occasionally, she even taught a class or two. Predicaments of any kind, personal, residential, financial, scheduling, could be addressed to this director of nurses. And in the early 40s, her name was Sister Ernestine Marie. Only slightly older than the students themselves, by all accounts, she was respectful and kindly and understanding and adored.
Nonetheless, here's a rant which never bounced off her walls. At one time, I had a roommate who was a kleptomaniac. She wore my shoes and broke down their heels because she weighed a lot more than I. She borrowed my towels, nylons, and even underwear, if you can imagine. I rarely had money, so that wasn't a problem. She had no compunction about using my cologne or cosmetics either. Still, we remained good friends, dated soldiers together whom we later married, and had our first children about the same time.
But you borrowed each other's underwear? No. All right. In 1941, a year's tuition ran around $60. The national annual salary averaged $1,750. Ongoing costs included textbooks, shoes, and work clothes. Once licensed, a registered nurse could wear any style of white she desired, but while in training, a nurse's outfit was truly uniform, appearing pretty near the duplicate of everybody else's. Hospital administration provided individual measurements to the Denison's Manufacturing Company, which returned a single piece of cotton garb. It buttoned down the front as far as the waist, and when slipped into, was cinched by a buckle-free belt. It flew a Peter Pan collar, was hemmed several prescribed inches below the knee, and had a deep pocket on the right thigh. Over the heart lay a SMH embossed breast pocket, and above was stitched one's name. Two outfits were the bare minimal, since the sisters insisted nurse clothing be spotless and pressed with the onset of every shift. Washing, drying, and ironing were freely provided by a basement laundry crew. Returning garments were starched so heavily they could be heard swishing the length of the hall whilst making rounds. It was a stiffness which could burn your neck.
In the early 1940s, St. Mary's was a rare Oregon nursing school whose uniforms retained long sleeves. The reason why continues to mystify surviving graduates who regularly had to roll them up and fasten them out of the way with elastic bands. One student reported sporting faux pearl studs for cufflinks. Yet by 1945, only Sunday's dress uniform still extended to the wrist. A wool cape colored navy blue with scarlet underside served as an accessory during outings or dress-up occasions. Not everybody could afford this accoutrement, however, and at least one was made by its owner's mother. Huh. The first 3 months as a probie were spent just hitting the books, learning basics, patient care, bedside procedures with a practice dummy, temperature, pulse, respiration, terminology. Teaching and demonstrations took place in various venues of the brick section or the medical library, which occupied St. Mary's original surgical room on the east side of the second story, or uphill at Astoria's High School, now Toller Hall of Clatsop College. Classes were ongoing through all 3 years. Instructors were local physicians, special education RNs, or resident nuns, and students stood when the doctors entered. High-performance standards were mandatory. Anybody scoring below 85% at the conclusion of a course had to take it again.
Yikes, I would have been on the 12-year plan.
By the fourth month, each freshman was provided ample opportunity to apply her learning, tending one or several wards whose 3 to 8 patients were fed, bathed, had their bedding changed, and everything in between. After a discharge, those items left behind got carbolized, which meant going over the bed frame, tray table, pillows, rubber drawings with a disinfectant-soaked rag. We learned our buttons, gravely concluded one veteran.
We earned our buttons.
Oh, we earned.
that's a little different.
Yes.
On the heels of this preliminary period came a capping ceremony around day 90. Earning permission to wear a nurse's cap marked acceptance of the person beneath as a bona fide student. You weren't a student up to that point? That's terrible.
Still potential.
During that classy era, the design of an RN's cap indicated when she'd trained, and such distinction accompanied her ever after. The headpiece itself was deceptively simple, consisting of a flat piece of stiffly starched linen, which was shaped along folded lines, then pinned to the hair. If soiled, it was easily undone and laundered.
Unlike modern medicine's three-shift workday in the 1940s, there were just two, from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. and 7 p.m. till 7 a.m. We still have two shifts, too.
Do you really?
We do.
That's terrible.
Well, there's, I mean, two and three, but lots of people work.
Oh, they have a choice.
I don't know all of that. Okay. But 7 to 7 is still pretty standard.
Interesting.
Inpatient. Somewhere amid that 12-hour stretch, however, everybody received a 180-minute break, usually spent napping. For those pulling day duty at 6 o'clock, bell would dispel any notion of staying snug as a bedbug. Therefore, 60 minutes were allotted to become clearly presentable, modest makeup only, both ears and fingers ring-free, briefly convene en masse in the chapel to pray for strength and divine guidance, and for breakfast. Perhaps followed by a class or two, lunch, several hours out on the floor, dinner, homework, and possibly even more lectures, or mayhap some entirely different slate insofar as students were assigned to a specific hospital department for one quarter year before transferred into another. With the nuns declaring lights out at 10 p.m., 10:30 on Thursdays, though, many a student logged many an hour studying by flashlight under her blankets. Others did the opposite, setting their alarms for 4 a.m. and then boning up until 6.
A precise number of days, 1,036, had to be attended before schooling was considered concluded, and any missed, for whatever reason, had to be made up. Everybody was granted 10 days vacation per year, plus one day off each week. Practically speaking, much of that 24-hour period was spent on necessities like cleaning your living space and bedding and civilian clothes or wrestling with homework. Regarding the longer lull, a 1941 enlistee gave this dollars and cents strategy. My vacations were timed for early fall when I could return to the Rogue Valley for pear picking season. I had become a migrant after leaving home at age 15, and by learning to pack rapidly, could finance nearly a year of school at Brigham Young University in 2 weeks of 14-hour days.
Hmm. Back then, BYU had a regulation which halved the tuition and fees assessed students of widowed mothers. We'd been wiped out by the Dust Bowl in Dakota, and my father sickened and died as a result.
Yikes.
St. Mary's had only one large capacity dining room. Located on the wood building's main floor, it serviced just the resident nurses. Patient meals served at bedside were prepared by an entirely different kitchen and cook in the brick wing. But widespread was the belief that fare dished out on the east tasted far, far inferior. Feedings convened at the standard times, 6:30, 12, and 5 p.m., and a student worked her schedule around them. Since those on duty couldn't leave simultaneously, they departed by turn. Some nurses contend everybody present rose before eating breakfast and joined in the Catholic grace. Others claim this was incorporated into the chapel prayer immediately beforehand. Non-Catholic girls still had to go to chapel every morning, so we learned the mass by osmosis. Dispensing was cafeteria style with a tray, and you helped yourself. Carefully. If dressed in pristine uniform, others ate in casual clothes if involved with any activity outside floor work. But the hard and fast rule was nobody dawdled. There was little incentive to do so.
In her book, Medical Mayhem, 1944, alumna D. Mitchell cites bread, beans, macaroni, and potatoes as wearisome constants of her nurse training diet. Parsnips were also big. Drink choices were the predictable coffee, tea, or milk, albeit during World War II, the former became dear due to rationing. A Protestant enrollee from March 1940 remembered lots of stewed figs and prunes. Ew. You'd have to be in the hospital for that. It was like depression fare at home, only not so well cooked. My mother has never forgotten the bread puddings. This is Larry's mother. Has never forgotten the bread puddings, occasional moldy smell. A later graduate experienced similar enduring memories regarding weevils in the powdered sage dressing. then encountered how shocking to a homesick girl that her first Christmas at school. In her Malala home, Christmas Eve was the big dinner and presents. At St. Mary's, the day before Christmas was a fasting day with macaroni and cheese Christmas Eve, yet a turkey banquet followed on the 25th.
Additionally, set on the east side's first level was a living room. Since no visitors were allowed upstairs, here was where such rendezvous and transpired. A departing nurse who expected to return after bed check was issued a late leave. This large reception area contained sofas, a ping pong table, an upright piano, and anybody could bang on its keyboard to any style music that was tolerated, but everything fell silent 2 hours before midnight. Now, the first floor of the old St. Mary's wasn't really its ground floor because said structure was built on a steep hill descending north towards the Columbia River. Meanwhile, a rock-solid foundation of rough-hewn blocks compensated for that slope, which meant its first floor rested on ground level solely on the southeastern Exchange Street, whereas standing at its opposite inside wall facing Washington State, one looked down on Duane sidewalks from a height of 20 feet. This contoured a basement that eventually stretched the length of the entire city block following the 1931 expansion, filling the space with were heating equipment, material storage, a temporary morgue, distilling apparatus. We made our own IV solutions until the crush of wartime, plus cleaning devices ranging from laundry machinery to the hospital's largest autoclave.
I would really like to have seen this build. I've seen pictures, of course, and this is kind of the best interior explanation I've gotten, but I would love to have seen that building. This was a squarish plaster encased metal box with airtight doors, which sterilized items via extreme steam heat under high pressure. All nurses were trained in the safe operation of such mechanisms, taught to be familiar with their normal pops and hisses. So if something went amiss, it would immediately register mentally that something was wrong. Attached to the backside of this bigger autoclave was a sheet of usernames entitled The Bells of St. Mary's. And Bell is like the woman, B-E-L-L-E. Disposable mindsets lay far in the future, so nearly everything got reused. And not just predictable implements of metal, but also bandages, tubing, towels. Nurses even resharpened needles with a whetstone. Making Q-tips in-house, however, was strictly to save banknotes. Ditto the patching of gloves. We tested them first by filling with air and squeezing. Then after finding the hole, we glued down a round circle of rubber from an old glove and air-dried it on a wooden rack.
Things have changed.
Yeah, folks. A little bit.
Yeah. Surgeries occurred on the fourth floor of the Western Wing, and Sister Attilia was in command. A pair of rooms overlooking the river for major scrubs, and between them, a supply area held Novocaine, IV bottles, saline solution, and sulfa. Until World War II commenced, penicillin was unheard of. A smaller autoclave in an adjoining cubicle could boil instruments as necessary dictated. Water was cooked by other appliances called sterilizers. Across the hall, a third surgical room for minor scrubs, such as the removal of stitches. Graduation required each student's involvement in the specific number of these major and minor operations. Since St. Mary's employed no interns, its nurses necessarily handled complex medical procedures, which contemporaries at other schools were only reading about.
So that's about a third of the article.
Yeah. It's so descriptive because he obviously did a lot of research.
And got a lot of firsthand accounts from people.
And he'd grown up hearing these stories too, right? From his mom about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just a lot of Larryisms in there. Yeah. Just some of the words and phrases.
I like his side notes to a lot of things.
So if you're interested, please check out our website or come in and buy one of these. Larry, you are certainly missed, and you were an important part of our growth over the past 15 years. So thank you, everybody, for indulging me in talking about Larry Zeke tonight. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.